Welcome to the Pharmacy Inspection Podcast, where we discuss topics related to sterile and non-sterile compounding pharmacy in an effort to promote compliance and increase quality. The Pharmacy Inspection Podcast is a member of the Pharmacy Podcast Network, delivering quality and meaningful conversations and discussions about our pharmacy industry and the critical role pharmacists play in our healthcare systems. Learn more at pharmacypodcast.com. Please welcome your hosts, Brian Prince and Seth DePasquale.
Hello to all of our compounding friends and colleagues, and welcome to an overdue episode of the Pharmacy Inspection Podcast. It's been a few weeks since we recorded a podcast, and we seriously and sincerely apologize for the delay. We appreciate those of you, our fans, who've been dropping us messages of encouragement to keep on putting out material, and that is certainly always our goal. We are less than a week away from Compounders on Capitol Hill at the Renaissance Washington, D.C. Downtown Hotel. We will be recording live at CCH from the Encore Scientific booth, which is numbers 38 and 39. So please drop by to give us more of that encouragement and even let your voice be heard on the podcast. We want to thank all of our friends at Encore Scientific for inviting the Pharmacy Inspection Podcast to be hosted in their booth. Encore Scientific is a manufacturer and distributor of high quality, compendial grade raw ingredients, buffers, solutions, lab equipment, lab supplies, and ready-made topical bases to the pharmacy industry, the cannabis research, development labs, as well as nutraceutical and the personal care markets. Encore Scientific's innovative products and processes will be on display at CCH, and the Pharmacy Inspection Podcast personally invites you to stop in and let their enthusiastic team introduce themselves to your compounding business. On this week's episode, number 24 of the Pharmacy Inspection Podcast, we welcome Christine Roussel, who I had the pleasure of meeting about a year ago at an ASHP conference where she impressed me with her vast knowledge of occupational safety. Today's conversation is going to allow us to share with you, our audience, some of her thoughts on occupational hazards and safety in the compounding industry. So let's jump in and welcome Ms. Christine.
So I started pharmacy as a student in a hospital and did everything from neonatal compounding to the OR suite, and then ended up at the cancer center. And I've always enjoyed sterile compounding, but within 3 months of working at the cancer center, I really started to worry about the things that I was working with and the chemicals that I was touching. In oncology, we see our patients come in and get treated, and some get cured and move forward, and some end up with getting secondary malignancies due to some of the medications that we give them that damage their DNA. So from that, I really just kind of got obsessed with hazardous drug compounding. So I've done it in a couple different spaces, hospital, specialty pharmacy. And my favorite thing is designing pharmacies for both patient safety as well as worker safety. So now I'm an assistant director of pharmacy at a hospital. I also teach at the University of the Sciences in their Philadelphia College of Pharmacy. And then I work as a consultant and educator and content author for Medisca and LP3, doing hazardous drug compounding, sterile, non-sterile, and then also clean room facility design on the side.
Wow. You have a lot going on.
I do, and I will be honest, I do a ton of medical marijuana education, too. I feel like that's the new thing. I do a department.
One of the big pushbacks that we've had from the industry, and more so, I feel like it's actually come harder from the home infusion side, but that's, we don't have to get into finger pointing, is where is the data to support USP 800? Where are the case studies? Where are the, you know, tox studies and all these things? And, you know, coming from my background in pharma, when we would design engineered containment for pharma, we always had to know what the OEL was, you know, less than 10 micrograms per meter cubed over a time weighted average of 8 hours. So tell us what your containment target is, so we'll know how to engineer and design to those targets. But that tox data had to come from somewhere, right? They don't just make that stuff up. And the thing is that we haven't got enough data that's driving independent community pharmacy and compounding pharmacy in general And so I really feel like that information is out there for guys like Tom. I mean, it's just, it's got to be out there, right?
I agree with you. There's a lot of pushback from several associations, including the American Society of Clinical Oncologists, who feel that there lacks sufficient evidence to warrant the type of engineering controls that are being presented. And I really think that though we don't have it clearly posted in terms of A, B, C, D to get all the information, I think there's significant data showing surface contamination on the vials of the medications as they come from manufacturers or distributors. We know that those chemicals are all over contaminating our facility, and that contamination has gotten on healthcare workers' hands, forearms, and in our bodies. So I find it very difficult to appreciate their feelings that there's a lack of information. And in the last 18 months, three conclusive meta-analyses have been published showing that using three different markers of genetic damage, there is this, you know, unfortunate association between increased DNA damage and people who are occupationally exposed to hazardous drugs compared to those who are not. So I definitely refute their sense that there is a lack of data. At least one study has shown that pharmacies have had occupational exposure limits exceeding that which is permissible by pharma. There's one clearly just looking at a closed-door pharmacy that was doing a lot of mail order, and they exceeded the level of lisinopril in the air. So I don't think people in pharmacies even know what occupational exposure limits are, and I think that's what puts them behind the eight ball just to begin with. Mm-hmm. So that's why I don't think they're testing to those standards, because they don't know that they exist. But there is documentation to show that there is air contamination. There's documentation to show that simply counting out pills on a counting tray will aerosolize drugs like methotrexate, which is an antineoplastic drug. Mm-hmm. It's a pressed powder uncoated tablet, and you will find it in every single pharmacy across this country for exposure. And there's definitely studies that support that, you know, what's in the air comes down on the surface and they can and show that contamination. So I do think that there is data. I think people are not as aware of it. I mean, there are studies that have shown levothyroxine in the air in pharmacies. So there's definitely aerosol, and surface contamination has definitely been shown in at least 20 studies in the United States. So there is data. I know that there's not a threshold at which it says what is hazardous, and that's one of the issues that they have if you look at data that's talked about chromosomal abnormalities in healthcare workers and the extent of the chromosomal damage. They can't really tie it to a level of surface contamination or a level of urinary exposure, but just because there's not a direct relationship with concentration doesn't mean there's not a direct overall relationship with qualitatively with exposure equals increased damage in the body. I don't know if that answers your question. I know people commonly say that there's not enough data, but there is. It's not a perfect puzzle, but there's a lot of pieces.
Oh, absolutely. So when we would perform the containment standards, we would use, you know what a Sensodyne breathing pump is? It's just a small breathing pump monitor. You put it on your, you know, it's almost like a beeper. It kind of goes on your hip, and then it goes, has a little tube that comes out, and it goes up to a small HEPA cassette, which you pin onto your lapel. And that would be the way that with those little breathing pump monitors, Sensodyne just happened to be one of the manufacturers at the time. That's how we would determine whether or not the containment standard that we were designing and engineering to was validated. And I talk about those. I talked about those yesterday at the ACHC, is that they're such wonderful tools. But so I could set up one of those breathing pump monitors with the technician, and then set one outside of the hood during, say, progesterone encapsulation, something that they do every single day in a compounding pharmacy. And I guarantee you, when I send those little HEPA cassettes off to the third-party testing analytical lab, they would come back with a detection of with progesterone in that, which means it aerosolized, or sometimes I say micronized, but it actually collected on that breathing pump monitor. But the point is that we've got, we've validated that it is present in the air. But then how does that translate to, well, we'd like to see that it does not exceed 100 milligrams over time weighted average of 8 hours. You know, so that hard piece of data doesn't exist. And I feel like probably what we're doing right now is getting way ahead of ourselves, where we should be talking about this on the podcast, right?
So this, like,
you know, let me just say, like,
I want to hang out with you. I just want to let you know.
We actually don't hear that a lot. What's up with, how come nobody's ever said that to us, Brian? That's messed up.
Well, because she doesn't really know us. That's why she's saying
that's it. That's it. Okay.
Well, listen, not many people know about OEL. So when I get very excited to hear people who are in that space and understand.
Oh, absolutely. That's how we would live and breathe and die. So a lot of my clients many years ago, so I worked for a company called Flow Sciences between 2009 and 2015. And so my clients were Merck, Glaxo, J&J, Bausch & Lomb, Therapeutics, Alcon's, all of those type companies at the R&D level. Sometimes we would get into the pilot plant manufacturing side as well. And like Glaxo was a good example of that. And so I've seen in lots of time where they're moving bulk, like 30 kg drums into, you know, processors or tablet presses or, you know, you name your piece of process equipment. I've been there and seen it and touched it firsthand. And so when you design engineer containment, you absolutely have to talk about OELs. And so every time I speak for the ACHC or any other organization, I pull out that word OEL and I explain to them that Section 11 on the SDS sheet, the toxicological section is actually the one that you need to pay attention to. It's not one that they just put there for the fun of it. However, what I'm finding that the SDSs that are put out there by, you know, name your wholesaler in the market in that space. And when they put no data available, it's like, or they'll say inconclusive or something like that. It's like, I can't believe that in this world that we've accepted the fact that that toxicological section, section 11, is blank or inadequate.
That's quite a compelling argument. And I think what's very interesting too is how those manufacturers, even drug repackagers, conduct themselves behind their own doors versus the clients that they market to as well. Because their associates are moving a ton of powder. Obviously, they're breaking them down into smaller containers or using drums. Mm-hmm. And they have a very high level of standard. And they have, obviously, occupational health personnel. And what information do they pass down of the knowledge that they've gained? I would argue that's pretty interesting.
Yeah. So for the majority of the clients that I deal with, Christine, they are non-sterile only. So I was just recently speaking at the ACHC, and we always kind of take a poll of, you know, who's sterile, who's non-sterile, who's both. And by and large, we are getting a lot of the independent community pharmacies that are compounders and non-sterile space only. And so they're dealing with, you know, drugs that are on tables two and table three, and there's a lot of the HRT drugs that they're dealing with. So how would you make that argument? Because I hear what you're saying about the vials, the contamination on the vials, you know, when you penetrate a septum, you're going to get an aerosolization of that particular drug, that chemo drug. But can we translate this conversation over to the non-sterile world?
So I think we can. So when I teach classes through LP3 Network for hazardous drugs, I'd say at least 75% of the audience are non-sterile hazardous drug compounders. So I definitely have to show them data that relates directly to them. So I always like to highlight a couple different studies. And I like to start with just a flat out, what happens when you have cancer and you go to a cancer center? You have to give them certain information. And every cancer center has someone who's responsible for tumor registration. And that means anybody who comes in, you have to log what their name is, their age, where they were, things like where they were born, what exposures they've had in life, what their occupation is, and put that into a database. So there was a group that looked at a 24-state cohort and pulled out pharmacists and identified that pharmacists were twice as likely to die of acute myelogenous leukemia than the general population. And so was it pharmacists who worked with cancer, or was it all pharmacists? And it was all pharmacists, so our retail guys, our compounders, everybody mixed in together, yet there was this association. And so it's not just, chemotherapy. You have to extrapolate that to the whole profession. And why people say, so what does AML mean? But when you think about all the different drugs that we're exposed to, when drugs penetrate our skin, and most of the times it's our highest contamination is from direct or indirect contact, we have a mishmash of drugs in our blood, right next to the most rapidly dividing cells that you have in your body. And that's why one of the most common toxicities from occupational exposure is leukemia. So I usually like to start with arguing that it's very unfair to make that assessment is is not universal to our profession because it is. I know I just kind of went from like A to Z and the hard data, but I think that's quite a statement. And people really stop and think about that, I feel, when they talk about, when they think about their risks over time and the things that they've touched. Just because when you count a drug on a tray, you're aerosolizing those particles. So many cytotoxic medications are pressed powder on coated tablets. You know, when you're counting that bottle of lisinopril, you get to the end, there's a puff of powder. But there's a puff of powder at the end of methotrexate, cyclophosphamide, and many other things. So just regardless of compounding with things, just even handling our oral solids is putting us at risk. So then let's take it the next level first, where you're thinking about having a jar of concentrated substances. You know, what are you doing to mitigate that risk? And there's plenty of studies showing that powders can hang in the air for well over an hour. And I always like to say to compounders, so, you know, everybody wants to buy beautiful micronized progesterone because, you know, it's very fine and it's easier to compound with. You have, you know, make a nice, much nicer topical out of a micronized powder. But the smaller we make our powders, the longer those particles will hang in the air. So usually when we start talking about that and just talking about the fact that methotrexate has been detected in the air in pharmacies really kind of gets people focused to say, okay, yes, there is some data. So is it just focused on non-sterile compounding? Not yet, but there is some across the whole spectrum of pharmacy profession in general.
What do you think what are some pharmacies doing? And we can take this both in retail and in hospital compounding. What do you think some pharmacies are doing that they can maybe change or adjust a little bit to kind of help bring down those exposure limits and not have so much powder just hanging out in the air, like you're saying?
So I think the first one is segregating the area where you're handling things that are known to be hazardous to a separate area. I think every different venue of pharmacy is going to have different things that they can do to contain different powders. In a hospital and in retail, I think the first thing is making sure that your hazardous medications are not included in automatic dispensing cabinets. That's the first one. And then if you're going to handle hazardous drugs, and specifically those that are pressed powder, uncoated, doing so in a separate area while wearing gloves, while wearing an N95 respirator, away from other chemicals, separate counting tray. I think that's the minimum and the easiest to do without paying for anything additional people should do for themselves and for those that they work with. I definitely think that people are starting to do that. I also like to remind people that in 1999, OSHA had a technical manual for safe handling of hazardous drugs, and it included only counting pressed powder, uncoated anti-needle plastics, and biologic safety cabinets. And while we don't all have access to one of them, I think that's also something that I know in my facility that we do. Hospitals have the benefit of purchasing drugs in unit doses, and so trying to limit contact, but whatever contact we do, make sure we're doing it in a primary engineering control. And on the retail side, creating that separate area. But when compounding with powders for non-sterile compounding, I think people need to just learn some simple techniques, such as, you know, when you open a jar of powder, make sure you're closing it right away. You know what I mean? Trying to use simple techniques like, you know, putting the jar and the spatula inside of your scale. So you're trying to minimize powder contamination everywhere else. Try to limit, you know, the locations where you're, pounding, you know, tablets to crush them, to grind them, to use for products. I think also doing personalized testing and practice to see where contamination goes is probably the easiest thing you can do for associates, and showing them how contamination spreads so easily. I'll give you an example. When we teach the non-sterile class through LP3, we make red lollipops, dextromethorphan lollipops, and then we also have people triturate powders with red dye so they can see how they make a homogeneous blend of these powders.
And you'll find that throughout the 3 days of the class, many people's products will turn up pink. People come up with a pink lip balm or a pink topical, and it's because of all that contamination, and they didn't realize where they spilled that dye. And making people do those activities creates a lot of awareness that just goes in a great direction for having them start to contain. And then the next step they really need to do is understand how to properly decontaminate chemicals and realize that alcohol is not doing anything but putting those contaminants into solution and wiping them everywhere.
Thanks for joining us today. This was an incredible eye-opening episode that highlights the risks associated with being exposed to drugs on a daily basis. Even the ones we typically feel are benign, when exceeding an occupational exposure limit can carry some risk. I know Brian brought this up several times, but taking a look at Section 11 of the SDS, the safety data sheets, can really be a lesson for you to go over with your employees just to impress upon them the risks involved with having poor containment practices. You can truly turn this into an educational opportunity that everyone can benefit from. If you're looking for help on developing better workflows and containment practices, contact us at podcast@pharmacyinspection.com or leave us a voicemail right on the website. This is what Brian did for large pharmaceutical manufacturers, and he really knows what he's doing and talking about. Honestly, even myself, after having a 20-minute conversation with Brian, ended up changing some of the workflows in my own pharmacy. Brian also has a great presentation on containment that I'll have to coax him into putting on the website. It's a really great presentation. Well, like Brian said, the Pharmacy Inspection Podcast will be at Compounders on Capitol Hill next week. We really hope you can stop by the Encore Scientific booth and speak with us. Unfortunately, I'm not able to get there, but Brian will be there in the Encore booth, so please stop by. Thanks again for listening. We really appreciate everyone tuning in. My busy season at the pharmacy is just starting to wind down, sort of the beginning of the end, which hopefully means freeing me up my early mornings and evenings for more writing and concentrating on the podcast a bit more. It's been great to be busy for the last few months. Business has been really good, and I've been involved in even some other projects as well, which in the next few months, I'll talk more about some of the exciting places you may be seeing me in the near future. Until then, I hope everyone has a great week, and as always, keep raising the bar.
The podcast you just heard was published with Anchor. Got something you want to say to the creator of this show? Send them a voice message using the Anchor app, free for iOS and Android.